Hello, welcome back to the Unstable Fluid Podcast, where he's Marty and I'm Doc.
Okay, right. Okay, that was good. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's not the worst one you've done.
I'm still riding off the PhD high. Like, the slowly things are getting changed over to Dr. Phillips. So it's there's going to be at least two or three more where I'm being cheesy about my doctorate, and then I'll calm down.
Okay, fair enough. Like, have you got the certificates you can change the bank over yet, or does that come in a few weeks' time?
I don't have the certificate. Bath do it that you get the certificate at graduation, right, which is novel. But I do have a nice letter from them saying, yes, she has her degree. Please treat her like she has a degree. So hopefully that might work. But also just waiting until January and graduation might be the way forward because I'm lazy.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's been like a month since we last recorded-ish, I think. Might be slightly more than a month. Not entirely sure. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So, yeah, in terms of like actual life things, everything is actually calming down. We have a job. It is stable. There's no like drama.
Famous last words.
Yeah, I've just started a new project, so I think that's going to kick everything into overdrive. But you know what? I could do with some more excitement. Finale of PhD life is I now have a hardbound copy of my thesis.
Amazing.
That's the update that way. It's very exciting. I did have a little cry when I got it because it looks all professional.
Nice. Color?
Burgundy or maroon, depending on how red you like your reddy browns.
Fair. Good color.
Yep, with gold print on it as well. Okay, so it's the Bath standards.
Yeah, I feel like sort of like burgundy or maroon with gold, or like navy blue with silver are the way to go on that sort of thing.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that. So Bath have, I think, black if you have an MPhil or an MSc.
Right.
So there are some big shelves in the staff room on campus that all of the maths department PhDs go in. And they go back to like the 1980s, I think.
Jeez.
Are the earlier ones. So there are some people's theses in there that are now lecturers and professors on campus, which is very cool.
That's going to go. We don't have that in Cardiff.
No, I think it's not a like requirement. It's more of a like, this is a time-honored tradition now, so you want to add yourself to it. So putting my thesis in there felt very final.
The tradition we have in the Astro Group in Cardiff is that rather than having like shelves where you put your thesis, we've got like a cabinet in the shared coffee space, which is where the cork from the first Prosecco you open after you viva goes, with a little plaque, like the card that says like your name and the date you vivaed.
Oh, I love that. That's very cool.
The problem is we're running out of space in it.
Amazing.
It's probably going to fill up in like the next month. We've got like 8 vivas in the group in the next month. I'm seriously concerned for my liver and my bank account.
Nice. I love a good tradition. It gets me all emotional.
Yeah, I think it's... I heard that the astrophysics department in Oxford, their like shared coffee bit has quite a low ceiling. So they fire the champagne corks into the ceiling tiles and have a dent that they put their initials and the date next to.
That's kind of amazing. I love that. Just maybe don't say that one to any staff involved with like looking after the building.
No, I mean, they know.
You didn't hear it from us. Hypothetically. Maybe they're fans. We don't know. Anyway, how are you, Thomas?
I'm all right. Kind of in a sort of like weird limbo of... I don't really have anything new that I've been doing because it's just all of this sort of repetitive. Like, I spent about a month and a half making relatively small edits to figures while I tried to get this stuff to display the way that I wanted it to. Now I'm just writing a paper, and that's just taking a while. But I am still having the sort of like weird out of body experience of I'm now a second year and I don't know how I feel about that.
You're not the baby anymore.
We got all the new master's students into our research group for this academic year because they're doing projects with my supervisor and the postdoc in our group. And I'm like, because the other two PhD students in the group are both doing their viva like this month, it feels like I should know at least a little bit about what's going on. I feel like I should know something, and I really don't, which is a strange experience, but...
You'll be surprised how much has like... assimilated into your brain when the babies start asking questions and the first years ask you like random factoids. It'll be something like, how does the printer work?
I don't even know how the printer works.
Okay, right, get on it. Come on, this is your job now. You're supposed to be guiding the next generation.
It breaks or changes how it works at least 3 times a month.
Okay, well, it's a lost cause then.
Yeah, it's university IT. But other than that, things are going relatively well. Yeah, I feel like I'm getting back into a bit more of a rhythm of things. Actually, weirdly, now that the undergrads have all come back, my routine has settled a little bit more. Whereas before, it was I was here, there, and everywhere, and nothing was happening when I expected it to happen. So, generally speaking, getting better.
Nice. Do you have much interaction with the undergrads? Do you do like teaching or?
Yeah, I have to do lab demonstrating. So, I have to. I volunteer to do it because I like money, but.
You are paid to lab demonstrate?
Yes.
I'm assuming computer labs, not like physics labs.
Yeah, in my case, it's computer labs. Actually, specifically, it's the computing labs for like general physics stuff as opposed to computing labs for astronomy. Yeah, it's like your standard like, computational physics module is the. It's what it would be called in a lot of places, but this one is this is like the second year module, so it's like called structured computing, I think, or something. It's teaching how to use like functions and stuff.
Oh, cute. Okay. I'm trying to remember. There were a few maths and physics undergrads while I was there at Cardiff, and I remember them getting very smug in second year because the maths part had a computing module first. Mm. So they'd done a lot of the intro to computing-y things.
Well, they have computing in first year physics now as well, so. Because I do that in the second semester.
Oh, nice. So you teach first years in first semester. No, second years in first semester.
First years in second, yeah.
Oh, no, you want to get first year, first semester. They're so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and feel excited. Mm. Second semester, everyone's too tired to care.
I don't have the energy for bright-eyed, bushy-tailed first years. Especially not at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning.
No, they're not bright-eyed. No one is bright-eyed at 9 a.m. And if they are, stay away from them.
Yeah.
To get very, like, reminiscent to my first years. And this is like 3 or 4 years ago now. I had a message last week or the week before from someone I tutored a few years ago. And I had them in their first semester, first year. And they are about to start tutoring this semester.
Oh, nice.
So they were like, hey, Kat, I'm about to do the thing. You were great at the thing. How do I do the thing? So that
I'm
going
to choose to believe
happy.
That is exactly how that conversation went.
I think it was more like, oh, dear God, I'm terrified. What do I do? But I just info dumped on how I look at teaching. Hopefully it helped. If it hindered them and they've actually, you know, it was bad advice, then maybe that isn't as great. But I'd like to think I've helped someone.
My fingers crossed. On the topic of people like reaching out and asking for advice and just generally talking to people, shall we actually maybe move on to what we're actually going to talk about in this episode, which is kind of networking throughout your sort of academic life? But mostly we're going to talk about it as a PhD student, I guess, because that's most of what our experience is.
I love a related segue, which, I mean, it's a good starting point.
It was nearly smooth.
Let's pretend I thought about it and that wasn't just like the random thoughts in my brain making like leapfrogging jumps.
To be fair, I think I'm here for the stitching together of all the random thoughts, right?
Yep.
That's my function, right?
Yep. I just info dump. This is my like lot in life. Yeah. So networking.
Yeah.
The working of net.
That's phishing.
Where does the word networking come from then?
It probably comes from the idea of a network and then creating a network, I guess.
Okay. Where does the word network come from? A net like arrangements of threads, wires.
Yeah. I was going to say probably that they laid out the, this is how all these computers are going to be connected and thought, oh, that looks like a net.
Yeah, turns out that wasn't that exciting. That was quite obvious.
Clearly it was named by a computer scientist, not an astronomer.
What would an astronomer call it? What's networking for astronomers?
Stressful.
No, okay, walked into that one. Fair play.
Come on.
Yeah. No, but it's true. Networking can be really scary. Like, if you're not aggressively extroverted, or if you are in a given particular day struggling with imposter syndrome or, like, a feeling of not belonging.
Wait, people do that on particular days?
In theory, there are good days and bad days, Thomas.
Okay, cool.
You would hope. It's not like every second Tuesday of the month people are like, today's the imposter day.
Maybe that's when they have to present in the research group. You don't know.
Okay, no, you got me there. But yeah, no, networking can be scary. And as someone that continually, seemingly, I managed to navigate it quite well, let's chat about it.
Maybe we should maybe describe exactly what we mean when we say networking in an academic-y sense.
Yeah. I guess generally networking then is sort of using spaces and just communicating and like reaching out to the wider academic community, right? Like there are lots of different people all around the world working on very similar projects or similar research interests. And rather than sitting in a corner on your own struggling with something, the best way to do good research is to learn about what's kind of going on right now within the wider community. And, you know, historically, you see this, like, ideas happen at the same time throughout history, like lots of people around the world, the same concepts will kind of pop up. So instead of having that complete isolation, let's talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the best example I have of, like, the same thing happening in lots of different places around the same time is that, like, the undo function on computers was independently developed, like, 6 different times, all within the space of about 18 months.
Amazing. How badly were people fucking up about that point in time?
How many times a week do you think you press Control Z?
I don't want to talk about it. Like, that's a private question, Thomas.
It's one of those things that just about everyone thinks, I really want to be able to undo stuff.
I love that that's your go-to, because mine is always like the invention of calculus.
I mean, yeah, but I was trying to pick something that didn't end up having to be like, right, but it wasn't just Newton.
That's fair. I mean, no, we love a good alternate example. But yeah, so having a good idea of what's going on sort of live and update is good. And you could just like look at the papers that are being published and go to archive and read all of the like recently published literature. But
that gets boring after a while.
Yeah, yeah. And like, it's not also the newest stuff. It varies subject to subject, especially where like patents and working with like client data or clinical trial data kind of comes into play. But typically people are giving talks about the stuff they are actively working on before it's published or while it's in preprint at conferences or seminars or workshops.
I mean, yeah, like the number of talks that I've heard at conferences where they're just like, they get to the end of the talk and say, by the way, the paper's on archive today.
As someone that's been giving the same topic of like, this will be published soon for the last 3 years. Yeah. The way that people know about my research is by talks.
Yeah, you're totally right. The publishing of research often happens like quite a while after the research has actually been getting done. Because there's lag. There's a lag between you finish actually doing the research and the paper is in a fit state that you could publish it. Some people like to put it on archive, like when they submit the paper to a journal. Others wait until it's been accepted to the journal. It depends on the research group and their personal preferences. So there can be massive lags between people actually doing the research and it being in a state to be published. So yeah, like the sort of networking, going, talking to people thing is the much faster route to know what people are actually working on. The big scary thing when we say networking is like that, I have to go and talk to people. But the bit that I think a lot of people kind of skip over in the panic is that a lot of those networks kind of come sort of pre-baked into your environment. Like your first network as a PhD student is your research group and your department.
Very much so. So the people that you start with, the people that are already inbuilt to your department, other PhD students, lecturers, you already have a network as soon as you get going. No one works in isolation. And even if that's, say, you don't have a pre-built research group, because not every system does work like that, your supervisor will have someone. That's your first point of contact. Maybe they have other students. That slowly builds it out. Maybe there are seminars that you could attend and people will be in slightly different areas, but all under some unifying theme. That would be sort of a good opportunity to network and see what other people are doing adjacent to your field.
Maybe for people who aren't currently in academic departments, maybe we should explain what we mean when we say seminar. Because I know not every university uses the word seminar for at least what Cardiff uses it for.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Is this going to be one of those we find out we talk about the same thing, but differently, or different things the same way?
Possibly.
So I mean a seminar as a sort of, they happen once a week throughout the term. And it'll be, so say the applied math seminar, it'll happen like once a week and there will be invited speakers or potentially internal speakers, but normally invited speakers from other universities to come and talk about their research in the topic of applied maths. And it'll be organized by one of the academics or multiple of the academics, and they'll get the speakers in. And yeah, this like an hour long talk with maybe some questions and just an opportunity to sort of hear some cool stuff. It's like a really, really slow conference.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what I would describe a seminar as, because that's what Cardiff describes it as. But I know other universities will describe that as a colloquium.
Okay, so... To me, a colloquium is then broader. So there's like the, in Warwick, for example, I'm slowly learning which seminars I want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like the applied math seminar, there's the fluids seminar, there's one called like SPAM, which is statistics, probability, and applied maths. SPAM, which is a little bit broader, but those are all seminars. And then there's a maths colloquium, which is all of maths. And then like it'll be completely different topics happening. So people who don't normally wouldn't say they're in the same field within maths would all get together for this one colloquium. So the entire department get together for the colloquium because it's a bit more broad.
I think it probably depends on the department. I mean, what you're describing there with Warwick is that you've got loads of different groups of maths that maybe don't interact that much with each other and need separate seminars. In the same way that we have like the astro and gravitational waves seminar, and then there's the condensed matter physics seminar in physics as well. But yeah, like I think maybe a more homogeneous department maybe wouldn't have all the separate ones. And I've certainly heard of departments like that use the term colloquium rather than seminar. And it probably is a department to department, university to university sort of thing. Terminology is weird. Words are hard.
But essentially, it's invited speakers talking about a topic that may or may not be like directly related to your field or just adjacently directed, but tends to be regular meetings of similar interested academics sort of coming together to hear about what's going on. And it's a lot easier to sort of go to because it's at your home institution, so it's just show up. And it's always a nice place to sort of start delving into networking. I know a few seminars back in Bath that have sort of, because it's the same people every week that go, they tend to get, maybe they go for lunch before or afterwards, or they'll have like a coffee meeting. And some seminars I know will have like a little tradition that the first question must always be asked by a PhD student.
Okay.
Which is terrifying when you are the PhD student, but can really help you get into that mindset of like, these are people in a space where it's actively encouraged to ask questions and talk to them. You're not rude for doing so. It can kind of encourage you to like start the conversation.
I think that's a really good idea because it can end up feeling a bit like we've got some academic in from goodness knows where. They've talked for 45 minutes to an hour on their research. And then you get four questions from some more senior academics. The PhD students say nothing, and then we all go back to work. So yeah, I actually really like the idea. I know the way that our department does it is that if a seminar speaker is in person rather than doing a seminar over Zoom, which is something to get with some of the international speakers. So if they're in the department, like they'll arrange, like somebody will take charge of arranging like chats with the seminar speaker for people who want to have a chat with them. It's not like half an hour over a cup of tea or coffee. And then we tend to have like you can go for an evening meal with them rather than lunch, because our seminars are like 2 p.m. So
okay, cute. Yeah, I think it depends sort of if they've come from afar. Typically dinner is implied if they have to stay over or whatever. I remember the first time, so I think at the very least a few universities I've been to, they have this as well, where, you know, they set up, you come and give a talk, and then they just fill your calendar that day because you've taken a full day off of work to come and give this talk somewhere. Yeah. So they want to make the most of that opportunity to network. So I remember I gave a talk in Warwick, and then suddenly my entire calendar, this was before I joined, was with who is now my potential boss, someone I'm looking forward to collaborating with, someone that was really interested in maths communication. So I'm guessing what happened was they sent an email around being like, does anyone want to talk to Kat? And then people sort of sign up and they have a chat about anything they're sort of interested in. And when you're a PhD student, again, that is really intimidating a little bit because it is that one-on-one talking, but also that can be quite a nice way to sort of broach networking. If it's someone who's researched, say you read their papers a lot and they've come and given a talk at your university, or someone whose content you're kind of interested in, or you do something vaguely similar, that can be quite a nice way to meet them, because it's sort of prearranged. You have a set amount of time to just chat. Normally what will happen is you explain what you do, they explain what they do. Maybe you ask a few questions or you just chat about something in the middle. Or if you're like me, you end up going off on a tangent and arguing about the rugby. Like, it's just a nice sort of a bit less stressful. There's not lots of people watching you ask questions. It's just one-on-one.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good opportunity. And it's one of those ones where you don't have to like go to an event to talk to them. Like it's fairly self-contained. It's normally about half an hour, probably. And it's half an hour in a relatively familiar environment, but it makes it probably the most approachable way to talk to somebody from outside your institution. There are, however, many other ways to talk to people from outside your institution, and some of them are a bit more stressful. The big one is probably conferences.
Yes. Yeah. So academic conferences, I am a massive fan. Conferences were like the highlight of my PhD, I would say, or like the travel and the going to workshops and events. I'm one of these weird introverts that are extroverted and are weird. I don't know where I fall on that line, to be honest. I love the environment of a conference. I think it's really fun. But I also think I have this opinion because I did a lot of networking really hard, really early on, which meant that now every time I go to sort of the conferences that happen annually or biannually, I already know a good number of people.
Right.
So it means that I'm not going into a space brand new, don't know anyone, which I remember being scary.
Yeah.
It took a few years to sort of warm up to, like, you know, I go now and I see people that, oh, it's you again. How's it going? Oh my God, it's been so long. Let's catch up, you know? First time round. I guess you've just done your first conference last year, this year?
8 months ago, yeah. It's
was it 8 months? Jeez, okay.
Yeah, it's like 8 months ago in like a week.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like from your perspective then, perfect opportunity. Going into it, how many people did you know that were going?
Two. My supervisor and one other PhD student.
Okay. That's more than none.
Yeah.
After you left, how many people would you say that you'd like networked with?
I'm not trying to think. Okay, how are we defining having networked with, as in having had a chat with?
I was hoping you'd give me a number and then I'd ask you that question.
Okay, sure.
I think that's the thing. I think defining how you network is difficult, right?
I think I'd probably put the number at somewhere between about 6 to 12.
Okay, this is really good. And like, it was a 150 people conference?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's like 10% of people.
Yeah, I guess so. I hadn't really thought of it that way. But yeah.
Yeah, that's really decent. Those are some good numbers. How did you quantify 16?
Okay, so automatically included anyone I'd gone to lunch with. Because those are longer conversations. And then that probably was around the sort of probably 6 to 8, I'd guess. I can't actually remember. And then there was a few more senior academics that I had more in-depth discussions with about my research in particular and emailed back and forth with and such.
Yeah, okay, so you did like follow-ups after the conference then as well?
Yes.
When you say emailing?
Yes. I think one of them happened during the conference because he said he'd send me something.
Oh my, okay, I love that. That's amazing. Yeah, perfect. I think that really highlights as well that like networking doesn't have to be sort of you've exchanged business cards. Not that anyone in academia has business cards, although I really want business cards.
We have QR codes on posters and presentation slides.
Yeah. We have academic websites or Instagram handles, and that's all we can hope for sometimes. But it doesn't have to be that direct of a like, right, we've exchanged numbers or emails or whatever. It can just be like, if you saw that person again at the next thing, you could be like, ah, either A, how do I know you? Oh yeah, I met you there. Or like, yes, let's chat again. So it's just building up that like slowly getting to know a bunch of people. So I love that you included both informal and formal settings of like talking about research, but also, yeah, just bumping into each other at lunch or like having a chat at lunchtime.
Well, this was actually the good thing about the conference I went to was like they'd got like lunch vouchers for the sort of cafe that was in the building where we were having the conference. But they only had enough, like they'd only included like 2 days worth of that for a 5-day conference.
Right. Okay.
So you could continue to go there and pay for it with money you claim back from your university, or what essentially was encouraged was there's like, we're right in the middle of Vienna. There's so many restaurants, go have lunch with people.
Okay. Love the, like, encouragement of smaller groups. Hate the not being paid for lunch. How dare you? That's unacceptable in my mind.
To be fair, the food wasn't great.
It doesn't tend to be. But it's free, and that's what counts. Well, I say free. You've paid entry. And actually, for the cost of having recently gone from paying student fees for conferences to, like, actual adult fees, I'm not happy about it. I want freaking 5-course dinners for the rate that you pay for some of these places.
I think this one was just a flat rate.
Still sus.
Yeah.
Still sus. But yeah, anyway, the networking bit. I mean, if anything, complaining about the food at a conference with the people stood next to you at the food queue is like time-honored tradition of networking.
True. Equally, it was really nice to go and get some food that wasn't vegetarian.
I like this switch to like everything being veggie. But the most recent conference I was at, everything was beige.
Yeah, but I was in a German-speaking country. They do meat really well.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, I suppose if it's an international conference, when you go to a conference in the UK and it's just more sandwiches, and it's the same uni caterers, I swear, like, catering across the UK has, like, dominated universities. Like, everyone has the same caterer, as far as I can tell.
I know I've been to a couple of universities that have, like, in-house caterers, but yeah. A lot of it is very the same. We're getting off topic. We've got sidetracked by food.
But like the beetroot falafel that the generic uni catering does is actually god tier.
I'm not sure I've ever had it.
So far, I think I've had it at 5 unis. So I'm convinced that that's a statistically significant sample.
Okay. Cool.
Cara type stats, it's not going well. But yeah, conferences are a big scary place to network. So how many people did your supervisor introduce you to?
I can't remember an exact number, but it was actually quite a lot because the conference I went to was very focused on galaxy like simulations. The whole conference was called Building Galaxies from Scratch. But the reason that I ended up getting introduced to quite a lot of people was that all of my supervisor's collaborators were there.
This is how we network, through other people's networks. You meet one and then they introduce you to more. It's like an MLM.
So there was that. also all my supervisor's collaborators were there. So I get introduced to them. But then the other PhD student in my group, who'd also gone, had met some of the other PhD students at the conference at a workshop like the year before.
This is really good.
It's almost like talking to people is how you get to know people, rather than standing awkwardly in a corner.
Talking to people is how you talk to people, can confirm. You heard it here first, folks. But that's fantastic, because as I say, you're going in as a first-year PhD student, now a second year, haha. But you're going in as a first-year PhD student at your first conference. Like, in a world where everything works the way it's supposed to, the people more senior to you who know you are the ones that are helping you make those initial connections. My supervisor introduced me to a bunch of people. One of my now collaborators is ridiculously social and ends up organizing the like conference pub trips. So they were a great person to know at a conference because A, they know everyone because everyone knows them.
Yeah.
And they are still like, I'd say still early career enough that we get on really well, but they also remember what it's like to be a PhD student. So they're really proactive on ensuring the PhD students are talking with the professors and the professors are talking with the PhD students. So really getting that open channel of communication, which is again why I say that my Viva was really not scary, was because that I'd been at conferences with my external before. So I'd met them in a professional and more informal professional setting already. Yeah, if you're going to conferences on your field, probably someone there will be your external.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a good chance of that. And like, I think it's very difficult, I think, when you're like at the bottom of the academic ladder to sort of, I don't know, like approach people that are a bit further up. Like even for like particularly first year PhD students, it isn't always the easy thing to even feel like you can talk to final year PhD students when you first arrive.
Yeah, which I think is why it's on the onus of the final years to try and make sure that like we are being friendly. We are being like, it wasn't that long ago we were first years. Like I say we, I'm not them anymore. I'm too old. But like,
it still wasn't that long ago you were first year.
Yeah. So it's like, I completely remember it being really intimidating, but hopefully there are people at that stage that are making sure that you know that you can talk to them. I actually used to have a lot of fun at a conference playing a game with one of my other PhD students who was a bit more senior, and we'd been to this conference before, of like who can race to introduce our first year to the most people. Very similar to Have You Met Ted from How I Met Your Mother, but like professional setting, not hitting on people in bars.
Yeah.
But just that sort of like, ah, this person works on the same thing as our friend. Let's like make that network. It can be a lot of fun. And I get a warm, fuzzy feeling when like I've introduced two people and they get to like, they work really well academically, or they now have a connection.
Yeah.
Because like people did that for me. So it's on me to kind of keep doing that for others.
No, I think that's really good. And that will make like attending conferences so much easier. Like, I think there's a pretty good chance there's going to be a load of people from the Astro Department in Cardiff go to the National Astronomy Meeting next year in Durham, because there's just a huge galaxies group there. But I think for quite a lot of the PhD students, it's going to be their first conference. Yeah, I think it's that sort of like, have you met insert person here?
Moving more directly on to like proactive tips then, one of the things that really helps. So a lot of this inspiration that I have is from BAMC, which is the British Applied Maths Colloquium that happens every year. It's my favorite conference because it's just a load of people in the UK getting together, having a good time. There's a big joint one with the British Maths Colloquium, which is different to the Applied Maths Colloquium that's happening this year. So it's going to be even bigger. But yeah, a lot of these tips and tricks that I have are sort of from my experience going to that conference. The main one that you could do beforehand, which is really good, is get in contact with an academic that's going, or if you are an academic that's going to a conference, reaching out to the department to be like, hey, who else is going to this? Because I remember the first year I went to BAMC, I knew I was going and I knew two other PhDs were going. So the three of us talked to each other a lot, mm-hmm. and we organized travel and we coordinated going together. And then it turned out there were about 10 people from Bath at this conference.
Right.
All from the same department. We all knew each other. We kind of get there and it's the Spider-Man meme just pointing at each other.
Yeah.
And like in retrospect, it would have been really good to actually coordinate a little bit beforehand. Now, we don't all have to travel together, but knowing that there are other people going. So now I think every year they do a sort of big email out to the department being like, hey, who's going to this? If it's any PhDs first time talking and you want to go through your talk before the conference, like let's pencil in a day. And like, they try and make sure that it's a really, because it's such a big regular conference for applied maths in the UK. Yeah, they try and make sure that like people have that exposure beforehand and the first year PhDs have a friendly face. And it's a really nice thing to do. And there's a math bio conference that do a similar thing. There's a stats conference that do a similar thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a nice way for departments to kind of show their PhD students that like, yeah, let's have that pre-built network with an academic and a PhD student, or, oh, I already know someone that's going that can help.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way to do things. And I think one of the things that I've heard people mention before, which I didn't end up doing for Vienna, but I know other people have done for other conferences, is when they're going somewhere international, quite often trying to like coordinate, okay, but can we get the university to put us in the same hotel? So we're not like, so you can go to the conference in the morning with somebody else that you know.
Yeah, yeah. Pre-arranging meetings and like bumping into people over the like Premier Inn lunches mm-hmm. that they have, you know, all that sort of stuff. It just adds to the like, it can take some of the stress away.
Yeah.
Strategically going to a different hotel than your supervisor because you don't want to bump into them, you know, like having an awareness of where everyone in your research group is,
yeah.
It can be helpful for whatever reasons. Not that I've done that. I know that that's something that it does help add to the stress of if you know where people are. You got any tips and tricks? You mentioned QR codes earlier.
I did mention QR codes earlier. So yeah. So particularly for anyone who's like a first year PhD student, a lot of the time, like when you go to a conference, you might not be doing a talk, or you might be doing a poster. Even if you are doing a talk, this still applies. Which is that if people want to get in contact with you, if you're at a conference of 150, 200, 700, 1,000 people, nobody's going to remember anybody's names. And on top of not remembering anyone's names, they might not actually get a chance to catch up with you at that point. And nobody's particularly good at scribbling down the rather convoluted formatting of university email addresses. So one of the best things you can do is just have a QR code in the corner of your poster or in the corner of your like final slide or something that's a link to your website or your profile on the university website or whatever else. Put a label saying what the QR code is too, but because people typically mm-hmm. don't want to scan just random QR codes. But having a way for people to quickly get the information they need if they want to contact you can be really helpful. And I know other people that have, if they've got like an analysis package, like a coding package that they've got like hosted on GitHub, they'll have like a QR code to that. And it's like, I did all this stuff with this package. Here, by the way, here you can download it.
Yeah, having a good signposting to your digital footprint, I think, is a fantastic way to do it. Like, obviously, we are entirely just online chronically,
I think is the phrase.
So obviously, like, on all my stuff, I link to my Instagram and I link to my Cat Does Maths and all of the Twitchy and the podcast, you know, like, we go a bit overboard, but even just having sort of your email written out, your website, I really strongly recommend people have websites, even if it is just like a landing page that has your photo, your university, your title, and like a short sentence with your interests. Like,
yeah,
it's going to be a lot more memorable for people to kind of load up on their phone and then look at it at a later date, and also help sort of jog that memory of like who you are.
It's also somewhere that you can have like direct links to your publications when you eventually have them.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't mention that because I still don't have
any. I don't have any either, so.
And then you can go overboard, and I know people that, like, you know, we put our teaching on there, and there are some really beautiful, I every time I redo my website, I just kind of scroll through different academics websites and have a look, see what people are using. But having a good, memorable digital footprint can be really helpful. If you want to go like fully down the rabbit hole of like memorability, having the same format and color palette on everything you do, including posters, talks, website, digital, social medias, can really help jog the memory. Again, I've gone overboard, but I have people telling me, oh, they remember my stuff because it's all purple and green and like it's very iconic. And I know someone that has, you know, a bit more toned down. But all of their slides and posters are all bright yellow.
I've had similar sorts of comments because I made like a PowerPoint like theme for my slides. It's all it's very simple. It's white with like blocks of purple, but it's the same sort of thing that I have on my posters. And when I redo my website, it will be a similar sort of thing there. And purple's just a good color. But not that many people...
Completely agreed.
Not enough people use it, so it's still distinctive enough.
Although, having moved to Warwick, where the official color is eggplant, I'm no longer special, and it makes me a little bit sad, but also very happy that I'm now in line with university branding.
Yeah, fair.
But yeah, having something iconic or like memorable about what you do can really help with getting people in contact with you. And also, if someone does something fun and funky on their slides, that's a really good opener to like network, in that if someone comes up to me and they don't know what my research is on, but they saw my poster and they were like, hey, I love the color scheme, I really want to talk to that person, you know? That can be like a really nice opener. It doesn't always have to be, you don't always have to have something about the research to talk to someone about. Like, there have been many talks where I have had nothing to say about their technical stuff because it's not my field, but like, I really like the slides that they used. Someone recently just had a load of memes in their talk, and I'm like, I love this. This is amazing. Let's chat. Digital footprints are important, and they can be a really nice way to network and also kind of touch base after the fact, like sending a sort of follow-up email is more common in some fields, less common in others. You're really useful if someone said, oh, reach out to me about XYZ, and then you have a good point of contact. But even just following them on social medias, if they have an academic or like professional social, it can like keep them in your peripheral and keep you in theirs.
Yeah, it's something that I think has maybe become a little bit harder, but also easier in recent years. I say recent years, I basically mean...
Why would that be, Thomas?
I was going to say, yeah, since Twitter went to shit, I will bleep that out. Since Twitter became X and it kind of just became a mess of AI-generated crap, academics who used to spend most of their time on Twitter have kind of dispersed to the wind. They're now on everything from like Threads to Blue Sky to Mastodon to... I don't know what else there is. There are other ones.
Instagram and LinkedIn are the ones where I've seen people disappear to.
Yeah, good amount of stuff on Instagram, particularly on Astro, because pretty pictures. But yeah, they're now, rather than just about every academic being on Twitter, they're now on just about everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But not everyone's on everything. But it means that regardless of which flavor of the hellscape that is the devastation of Twitter, whichever flavor of social media you went to after the happening.
The end of the world, you mean?
No, it's the end of the bird. The point is, whichever flavor of social network you now favor on the internet in the aftermath of Musk's takeover of Twitter, there will probably be people in your broad field that are on these social media websites. So you can follow them, you can get in contact with them if there's something you really want to talk to them about. You can't find an email address provided. But don't, obviously, not everyone's going to respond. Some people don't check it that often.
And some people don't I don't respond to DMs on socials. I will respond to the appropriate emails.
Yeah.
But I think I say that somewhere. I should say that somewhere. But at the very least, like, if someone's posting about their publications or they're posting, oh, I'm at this conference, and you're like, hey, same. It's a nice way to sort of keep in touch.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, whilst the social media platform formerly known as Twitter is dead, there are still academic networks kind of happening dotted around the media platform. Oxford Mathematics Department have pulled out all the stops on TikTok. I don't know if you're following the Oxford Maths on TikTok. They've started posting just like fun little snippet videos with all their academics of like, here's a fun toy. And it's like the spinning tops with John Chapman and a double pendulum. And some guy's got the like the Stokes flow in the... They're really good. They're very simple, but like, honestly, props to them for a department, because like, I really enjoy those videos.
I'm going to have to check them out.
We're not sponsored.
But this is the point we're trying to make, is that social media can be really good for just finding out about other things and other departments that exist and such. And actually, the other thing that it can be really good for is, while not every academic is going to be really active on social media, things like various societies and more concrete networks will typically have more of a social media presence. So that can be things like the Royal Society, the Royal Astronomical Society, Royal Society of Chemistry, all of the Royal Societies of Things, if you're in the UK. I'm sure things like the American Astronomical Society and all of the place academic discipline society things that exist around the world. But all of these things will typically have some sort of social media presence, whether that's on the platform formerly known as Twitter, or on Threads, or on Instagram, or probably on all of them, because they'll have somebody employed to actually do this stuff. These accounts will share things like events and other things that might be happening. And sometimes they're virtual events, sometimes they're real life events. And it can be a really good way to find out that there are other things happening. And some of the things that they post will be things that are slightly like, I don't want to use the term engagement bait, but it'll be something like, who are our followers? What are you working on? Etc. And the comment section is just full of people saying, I'm a third year PhD student at whatever, doing whatever. And it can be a way to find people doing what you do.
Yes, yeah. The one that you reminded me of there is the Institute of Maths applications actually have an early career committee, and a lot of these places will have.
Royal Astronomical Society does as well.
Yeah, and they actually tag on networking events. Two big conferences in the UK. So they run the sort of like icebreaker style event for early career people at conferences.
Yeah.
So they can be, even if they're not isolated to they're hosting an event themselves, like these societies and institutions will be aware networking is really important, and they'll normally try and promote that, you know, by paying them a small monetary fee to join their society. Typically, they'll also be trying to help improve the networking across the board.
Yeah, I think there's I'm pretty sure at the National Astronomy Meeting, the Early Careers Network for the Royal Astronomical Society will be like, hey, this like day one, 2 p.m., come get like free cake and coffee and chat with other early career researchers. Because, yeah, they know that academics want free food and free coffee.
But it's that like, or socialization.
Organized fun.
Organized fun. Everyone loves a bit of organized fun, especially in academia. That's basically what we signed up for. But yeah, so there's loads of societies. There's, you know, you can start getting down the rabbit hole. There's also, if there isn't one for just the broad scope of like maths or astronomy or applied maths or anything, you know, academic related, there are tending to be more and more initiatives and groups and networks for specific sort of underrepresented groups. Mm-hmm. The one that always comes to mind that we shamelessly promote because we're friendly with them and we love them is Piscopia, which are trying to help underrepresented genders in maths. There's currently an up-and-coming queer network trying to get started in maths in the UK. And there are other sort of institutions started about that I'm sure exist that I would love to hear about. So if anyone knows about more mathsy networks, please do reach out.
Yeah, reach out on the Instagram, the emails, the things. And I'll pass them on to Kat.
But they, again, are trying to like make sure that, you know, hey, I'm a person interested in this thing or doing this subject. Like, I want to know other people like me. And sometimes networking can be really scary with insert arbitrary professor. So knowing someone on your level with similar background, with similar interest, it can be a really nice place to start.
Sort of looping back to conference things, like maybe there's a professor at a university that you don't go to that you want to know. Chances are that the PhD students from that university probably know them and could introduce you, and they're much more approachable because they're on the same level you are.
Have you done that directly, just tried to like network through people?
Not explicitly tried to do it, but it kind of happened by accident.
Nice. Yeah, I think the only time I've like actively tried to scout out university specific students was again when once I knew who my external was going to be, just to be like, hey, what's he really like? what's the actual goss like? What's the, you know, give us the tea. They all said he was lovely, and he was, so go me.
I didn't do it intentionally, but it was, I mentioned, there was a guy at the conference I went to that I wanted to talk to about, like, the stuff I was working on, because he was, like, the expert in that bit of astrophysics. But I'm like, I am nervous. I was pretty nervous, and then mentioned it to somebody else that I got talking to. I was like, oh, I really should talk to him later in the week. And they're like, oh, I just had a chat with him. Come here.
No, I think there are most people at these events either remember what it was like or are more than happy to chat about, you know, essentially we're all interested in this topic. And yeah, being that person as the go-between, like if I knew that there was someone that someone wanted to talk to, I would happily be that person because I remember what it was like and it was scary. And hopefully more and more people at conferences, like at the very least, I think I've been quite fortunate that the conferences I've been to have been very open and friendly in this way.
Yeah.
Which is nice. But yeah, okay, so you meet someone at a conference or a seminar or like a workshop, or you go to a thing and you meet a person and you're like, they do really cool stuff. How do you keep that network going? How do you keep that connection?
I mean, there's a few different ways you could do it. The most obvious one is probably email them afterwards. I don't know. I'm not sure if I've done it that much. You're probably way more of an expert on this than I am because I've done one conference. But like, the thing that always makes me laugh is whenever there's those articles, it's just like 10 things scientists don't want you to know. And clearly they've never met a scientist, because if you show even a modicum of interest in the thing somebody's really passionate about, they will talk your ear off about it. So if someone's given a talk and you email them after saying, I thought your talk was really interesting, by the way, I have a load of questions, they will probably answer them. In detail.
Yeah, I think if it's me, I normally go for like, hey, do you want to like call and chat?
Yeah.
Replying to emails scares me. But yeah, so the go-to, especially if you have sort of something dedicated to ask or something direct, is do an email. The like secret, you said like no one writes down emails. I try and make a list.
I try to as well, but there are some universities that don't give their PhD students like emails that make sense, and it's like C and 8 numbers. I'm like, that's not helpful.
Oh, yeah. But in terms of like, if I go to a talk, so I have a little thing on my notepad and I keep track of every talk I've been to, and I try and at the very least just write down like the name and the university and then the talk title. I also find that it helps me pay attention to the talk if I treat it like a lecture and like make notes.
Yeah, same.
And that also does help with questions. Fun fact, if you write notes, you'll remember what questions you want to ask. But you'd be surprised how much of a lag you can actually have with that sort of following up. So the one I can think of is I'm organizing PhD Your Way again this year, just up and coming. This is my online open day for maths PhDs in the UK.
It may have passed by the time this episode comes out.
yeah. Runs in November if anyone is interested.
It will definitely have passed by the time this episode comes out.
It'll run next year.
People in the future, go to PhD Your Way.
Yeah. How late are we planning on putting this out? Because if it's next September, that's perfect advertising.
It might be like a week after PhD Your Way.
Anyway, so I'm organizing this thing and I'm trying to get in contact with a bunch of universities across the UK to get them involved. And I got to the point where I'd kind of run through my sort of active network. I'd run through the active network, and I was running out of, you know, people I knew. So I just started cold emailing. So I was randomly emailing heads of departments. And then I remembered 2 years ago, I went to a workshop. And at this workshop, I chatted with a bunch of people. So I managed to find my list of people that I met there. And I was like, ah, they're at a university I haven't spoken to yet. They're at a university I haven't spoken to yet. So I dropped a bunch of emails being like, hi, it was great seeing you 2 years ago. How have you been? This is what I've been up to. Could you do me a favor? And I actually had positive response from that. Like, I had a nice chat with someone. They felt legit. Obviously, I've had like big career changes since then. So we had a nice chat about it. But just starting off that email, rather than a cold email with that, like, hey, I saw a talk you gave 2 years ago and I thought it was really cool. And like, I'm a real person and we've interacted, can be a really nice like opener. Because it'll hopefully, you know, dream situation, they remember you. Realistic situation, they will remember that they were at that event or they did that thing.
Yeah.
And it will put that connection a bit stronger from just like, this is a complete stranger email.
It moves it from like a fully cold email to a lukewarm email.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, obviously, you know, in an ideal situation, you are building that network really, really strongly, but realistically, you don't need to know every person all of the time. But having those connections sort of loosely in your mind of, if you have the list somewhere of, I went to this like talk or I went to this conference, and I do, I keep that on my website of every talk I've given and every conference I attended, because it can be really useful if someone's trying to contact me of like, oh, we were both at this thing.
I imagine that's something that gets easier the further through your academic life you go, though.
As long as you start documenting sooner rather than later. Yeah. I decided to try and count back all of the talks, and then I'm scrambling to find, what was my abstract from 4 years ago? I don't know.
That's why you store it in something that's on GitHub.
Well, now I will.
But yeah, I think, yeah, it's certainly a good point. It's like, people are far more likely to respond if you have even a tangential connection. And it might not be you've been to a conference with them. It could be something as simple as, hi, I'm so-and-so. This is somebody that I work with, and they said you were a good person to ask about this. Continue on.
Yeah, yeah. Even just that, like, I know this person, you know, they told me to get in contact with you, is a great starting point to establish a connection. Or yeah, even just, again, it was that like, hey, you shared a supervisor with my friend, you two should talk. And it's like, you know, 30 years gap, but suddenly they have a really good like starting point to chat about that they wouldn't have noticed without someone sort of like helping that introduction be made.
Kind of covered most of the bases on networking at this point, right?
I think the like the real answer, now that you've listened to us for God knows how long, is there's no quick fire easy solution to this sort of thing. And also sort of treating networking like very, very clinical detracts from what you get. But just be aware that everyone is constantly like, they're in the same boat as you, trying to like establish those connections, because the more people that you know in academia and in your workspace, the friendlier of an environment hopefully it can become.
Yeah.
So going into these like situations with good faith, finding a designated extrovert to do all of the introducing, that's like a career stage above you, really helpful.
Yeah.
If you are not at the bottom rung, being that person.
Find a designated extrovert, I think, is kind of the main takeaway from this, isn't it?
Basically, yeah. And then I realized that I am, like, as you go up the seniority, your like willingness to be extroverted increases. So like, I am now that person for quite a few people. And then you get to watch them go be extroverted, yeah. And it's all lovely.
And with that, shall we talk about some cool stuff that happened recently?
Oh, did something cool happen recently, Tom?
Yeah.
What happened? What's going on? What's happening in the world of space?
SpaceX caught a rocket.
Okay, so I saw a video of this, not knowing what was happening. And I saw a video of the tail end of this. So I think I saw like the cool bit. But I just thought it was a failed launch. So explain to us what happened and why it was cool.
Okay, first disclaimer, Elon Musk can just go away. It's SpaceX, I have to preface it with that. The engineers at SpaceX, insanely impressive thing that they've just managed to do. So they're currently testing their new like super rocket called Starship, which is basically gigantic, like, I think it's something like 25 meter, I might have been making up that number, very large top section that goes into space. Equally large booster that contains all the rocket fuel and does the launch the thing into space. SpaceX's whole thing is to try and make rocket launches cheaper they try and have reusable boosters. They've been doing this for a while with like the Falcon 9 boosters and the Falcon Heavy boosters that can land themselves on like a robotic ship in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, so before you go down the what's cool about it, so getting this right, prior to SpaceX, there would be like a bit of ship goes off into space and is ship.
Yep.
A bit of ship explodes, goes in the sea.
Basically goes in the sea or stays just permanently orbiting for ever.
Okay. That feels wasteful.
Yeah, space junk's a huge issue. Yeah, up until now, that's been kind of like the go-to thing is we burn all the fuel and then we dump the rest of it in the sea. What SpaceX were doing to try and like minimize costs was land the boosters, basically refurbish them and use them again. So you've had some Falcon 9 boosters that have been used multiple times to launch like the Dragon capsule into space up to the International Space Station. The thing with Starship is huge, like ridiculously big capsule, essentially requires a lot more grunt essentially to get it into space. And that makes the booster very heavy, and it's not really possible or practical to try and land it on a drone ship. So instead, what they've done is still do the whole like retroactive, like use fuel to slow it down, and then they've just caught it with a thing at the launch pad, which is just kind of wild.
Caught it as in like it's gone back to exactly where it started, or there's like a secondary thing to catch it?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it's landed back where it started, which means it may have just done a lap of the Earth.
Oh, well, that's quite cool.
I'm not 100% sure.
I mean, it's impressive anyway.
But yeah, they've sent it back to where it went.
Okay. Because looking at it, it was like a giant scaffold with like two arms that looked like the claw game that you get in arcades.
Yes, they called it a chopstick maneuver.
Okay, well, that's impressive.
But essentially, it's got these like metal grate things at the top of it that like to open when it's coming back in. It slows it down a bit and then the rocket engines do the rest. And it's come down onto where the launch pad is. The big scaffolding arms come in and those metal grates like sit on the scaffolding arms, rather than it trying to land on landing gear like the Falcon 9 stuff does.
Okay, so it's basically like landing on the scaffolding-y thing.
Kinda, yeah.
Okay. But is that not hitting it with a load of force?
They essentially slow it down to be near zero speed. They bring it from like 1500 kilometers an hour to zero.
How much extra fuel is that using?
I don't know. Probably quite a lot.
This is an interesting cost analysis there between like the amount of extra fuel being used and the like, I suppose, rebuilding the entire thing.
Yeah, it's probably the fact that you don't have to rebuild the entire booster and all the material cost of that.
I suppose the real test will be like reusing it second time around. So are these like unmanned?
At the minute, yes, these are definitely unmanned. Or uncrewed, sorry. Uncrewed is the official NASA term.
Ah, yay.
Something that we keep trying to get the media to like figure out, that it's that crewed and uncrewed are the terms we use now, but...
I mean, best of luck.
Yeah.
I did not know that. So that is interesting.
But yeah, it's really cool. And essentially what they're trying to do with Starship is to have something that can take much larger payloads into space, with the idea being that rather than sending a load of small ships, there's a load of small spaceships to Mars, you could send one Starship containing a load of stuff.
Well, I learned something new today.
Yeah. And SpaceX caught a rocket, which is just cool.
I'm sad it's not in like a giant baseball mitt like you would picture in a cartoon.
Big green hand from Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
I really hope someone's had to go and Google big green hand from Star Trek now. You're having to Google it now, aren't you?
Well, I'm just checking you haven't recommended something weird. Apollo's hand. Okay. Which Star Trek is this from?
Original series. Like 1960s.
OG Star Trek is so silly.